This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get two perspectives, one from a documentary filmmaker, another from a Center for Constitutional Rights attorney, on the one-year anniversary of the government shutdown of the protesters at the Dakota Access Pipeline site in North Dakota. And it's not over. There are lessons to learn because private military forces that were employed against the protesters are now hard at work in Louisiana, the southern terminus of the pipeline. The United States has been in a state of perpetual war since September 11th, 2001. Now, President Donald Trump has called for a military parade on November 11th, Veterans Day. We talk with Ajamu Baraka, the head of Black Alliance for Peace, about this glorification of violence and war.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
It's now more than a year since law enforcement evicted the last Dakota Access Pipeline resistance camps. The pipeline was near completion and was supposed to cross sacred Indian land in North Dakota in order to bring dirty Canadian tar sand oil from north to south through the United States to Louisiana. Then, the project was stalled by a tremendous solidarity movement led by indigenous peoples along with their allies, only to be green-lighted by the newly elected Trump administration, which has proven to be a handmaiden of the fossil fuel industry. We speak today with Eli Kane, a New York City-based producer of the documentary On a Knife Edge, which recently aired on PBS. The film follows a young Lakota man as he grows up on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota and becomes politically active and ends up at Standing Rock. Eli Kane has worked in film and music for 15 years. He has made two other documentaries for PBS about land rights and food sovereignty. We speak as well with attorney Pamela Spees. She's an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and represents environmental justice groups opposing the efforts of Tiger Swan, a private military company which worked with corporate and government entities at Standing Rock in an attempt to suppress the movement there. Tiger Swan is now active at the southern terminus of the pipeline in Louisiana. Eli Kane, attorney Pamela Spees, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to
Thank
be
you.
Here.
Eli, tell us about your film, On a Knife Edge. Who are the protagonists?
It's a father-son story. It's about the Dullknife family, and the father is Guy Dullknife, and his son is George Dullknife. They live out on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. And we follow George as he grows up, and his father's a single father, raising him to become sort of the next leader of their family.
What was it like doing a film over the course of five long years?
Surprising. This is the first film that I made that's, I would say, purely an observational film, an observational documentary. The other films that I've made have more of an essayistic component to them.
What do you mean by oppositional?
Observational.
Observational.
So we were just following.
It's both.
Yeah, it's both. We were following George, and we didn't know exactly when the film would end. We knew at first we thought, well, this will be like a year in the life of. As things developed, we started to realize this was a longer-term project, and we were going to be following George. I think the first interview that we conducted with him, he was 14. That was April 2010. And the last interview that I did, he was 20. And that was at Standing Rock in December 2016. So we didn't know what was going to happen. A few years in, we started really talking about, how is this film going to end? It's going to, you know, it's a coming of age story. It's going to end when he's a man. But what signifies that?
Well, what kind of issues does the film deal with?
Well, George becomes very active in the American Indian movement, and his father is an old veteran of the American Indian movement, and brings him in to that and sort of tells him about family history, the legacy of struggle and resistance that is that's part of their family. And the American Indian movement was involved in lots of different issues when we were following. One of the main issues that we saw was White Clay, Nebraska. And I don't know how much you want me to get into that.
Yeah, White Clay, Nebraska had to do with alcohol sales, didn't it?
That's correct. The brief, the sort of statistics on White Clay is it was a a small unincorporated town right on the border of Pine Ridge Reservation. Pine Ridge Reservation is a dry reservation, so illegal to possess or sell alcohol. White Clay was right on its border. Official population is 10 people. And up until very recently, the entire town consisted of essentially four liquor stores. And they sold the equivalent of 5 million cans of beer every year. It was recently shut down. The brief story is the Nebraska Liquor Control Commission revoked the licenses of the four liquor stores. Those owners sued, and the Supreme Court of Nebraska upheld the liquor board's ruling. So no more alcohol is being sold in White Clay. And I think, I will say, you know, the legal side of it is not something I'm that familiar with, but I will definitely say they've been trying to shut down White Clay for decades. And I definitely think that the agitation on a street protest or a rally on that level, it certainly helped move the moral compass of the Liquor Control Commission to rule in that way.
Well, alcoholism is a plague, of course, and so is suicide.
That's correct. Yeah, we deal with that in the film. January and February of 2015, there was a rash of suicides among young women on Pine Ridge Reservation. I think it was estimated that over 100 attempted suicide, and I think it was something like 20 were successful in that, and that was before February 20th of 2015. So the president of the tribe or the tribal council declared a suicide state of emergency. In the film, it cut very close to home. It affected some of the protagonists as well. So
yeah, well, I can imagine. Let's go to a clip from Eli Kane's film, On a Knife Edge.
People say the Indian Wars ended in 1890. All of us Lakota, we know that the war is still going. And it's just a never-ending cycle.
My family, the Dolnai family, we're defenders of the people. We always have been. We were fighting the United States government all the way up from, you know, Indian Wars, and now we're still fighting it today. My great-great-grandfather, Chief Dolnai, the same blood that runs through his veins is the same blood that runs through mine.
Got my keys?
Tell my kids, just don't sit there. You have to get up and do something for the people. Even if you know it's scary, you have to do it. It's your job, it's your duty. I'm teaching all my kids what my grandpa taught me and my dad. George, he's kind of like my sergeant. That's how his great-great-grandfather started. Started from way at the bottom. We worked his way up to become a chief. So hopefully George will someday become something. I hope I live long enough to see that.
My truck is officially a war pony now.
Sure, it has warrior on it.
Warrior, yeah.
I got to put on the warriors.
The pony on the top.
Yeah. White Clay's main goal is to keep the Indians down here and don't let them get up here, you know? To keep them fighting each other, to keep the alcohol on the reservation so that the Indians won't be able to rise up and finally see what wrong has been done to them.
That was a clip from the film On a Knife Edge. Protagonist George gets to Standing Rock and is part of the whole struggle. And that's what I wanted to talk with you about, Pam, because you're involved in litigation against Tiger Swan. Tell us about Tiger Swan, its role as a private militarized police force. It worked with the corporate and government entities in North Dakota, and it's still working a year after the Dakota Access Pipeline was successful, and Tiger Swan is still in business. Tell us, what is Tiger Swan, and then I'm going to ask you what you're doing in terms of litigation with them.
Sure. So Tiger Swan is, as you said, it's a private military company, private security company, made up of former Delta Force veterans, you know, of folks who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan. James Reese is the founder of Tiger Swan, and set it up as a private security company to offer security services domestically. But they're still also offering security services in Iraq and, you know, to supposedly help with the transition there. They're now marketing themselves as a security company in post-disaster situations, particularly in Puerto Rico and in Houston after the hurricane. So they're marketing, you know, it's interesting because on the one hand, and I think a recent piece in The Intercept pointed out the irony of this, is that they were working in Standing Rock with for Energy Transfer Partners, which is the company behind the Dakota Access Pipeline, you know, on a fossil fuel project, and what they were doing there was very problematic, and I'll go into that in a moment. But then on the other hand, they're marketing themselves in an era of climate change and trying to position themselves to be seen as a necessary component in the aftermath of natural disaster that's fueled by climate change.
Their model is a military one. I read the Intercept's coverage, the documents that The Intercept was able to get.
Right.
They view people like us who would resist the fossil fuel industry and their destruction of the globe, they view us as insurgents, terrorists, really, and anything goes in terms of the kind of stuff that they do against movement people. What were they doing? I'll ask this question of both of you, and maybe your protagonist was involved in this. What were they doing to the protesters at the pipeline up in the Dakotas?
Before I go into that, I think what you just said, the business model. It is a business, and in order to keep getting business, they have an incentive in amplifying and exaggerating the threat level, right? And so in order to be seen as necessary to these companies, they need to sort of create an enemy that, you know, they can then bring this overwhelming, what they call an asymmetrical response.
Asymmetrical
responses is something they say they specialize in. And so in order to do that, they've got to justify their existence, right? And so what they were doing in Standing Rock was, as the documents show, they were playing this role of liaising and coordinating other private security company responses, because they weren't the only ones there. There were a whole range of private security companies that were contracted by the company, ETP. And so they were coordinating that and then liaising with all of the law enforcement agencies, so federal, state, and local. And so you see this interaction and this coordination happening between private and state law enforcement, basically security and law enforcement. You know, it's well documented that what began happening at Standing Rock, of course, you know, you have Labor Day of 2017, where there are private security folks who encounter protesters, and there are dogs that are unleashed. It was very violent. It was escalated by the security company employees with dogs. And then there was, you know, from there on, you know, we saw things get increasingly, the response by the local law enforcement getting increasingly more violent and problematic, right? And dangerous. And so what we now know because of these leaked documents is that Tiger Swan was behind the scenes and doing these security assessments and referring to, as you said, referring to protesters as insurgencies, likening them to jihadist insurgencies. And that means something in this post 9/11 context when you have the security apparatus, you know, functioning the way it is. So it was very, very problematic. We know that Tiger Swan has since been trying to maintain its relationship with the pipeline company, with Energy Transfer Partners, and in that process was also trying to get into Louisiana, where the same company was running the southern end of that pipeline network. So there's a whole situation playing out in Louisiana now that is an offshoot of what was happening at Standing Rock.
Yeah, you got to drive a wooden stake through their heart. So they're still surveilling, I imagine, disrupting the movement people down in Louisiana at the other end of the pipeline.
Well, I should say one of the other features of Tiger Swan, one of the ways they market themselves is not just the security operations, so the physical security operations, but they also have what they call, well, it's basically a propaganda effort. So they were also trying to affect the messaging that was counter the facts of what was happening on the ground and the way it was being reported through giving this, through launching these videos where they wouldn't necessarily identify that the person in the video was working for the private security company that was working for ETP, but giving this, but trying to give this narrative that the protesters are lying and everything you're hearing in the media is wrong. So that was another piece of what they were offering to Energy Transfer Partners. And then, of course, the surveillance piece of all of this as well. So they, you know, there are these different components they offer as part of their suite of services. And the propaganda piece is one very problematic one. And I think we have seen that in Louisiana and Pennsylvania.
Eli Kane, let me bring you into this conversation.
I wanted to add something to that because I think, in addition, we've seen a lot of images, you know, of the violence that took place on that sort of front line of the dogs that Pam mentioned.
Freezing water.
You know, I think there was definitely a moment. I think it was Thanksgiving 2016 when all these images were, you know, circulating online of, like, you know, people being sprayed down with high powered water hoses and freezing weather. And it was like the irony of Thanksgiving, you know, it's like, and that to me woke a lot of people up. It's got a lot of people talking about the irony of this, and we really need to pay attention to what's going on here. Rubber bullets, tear gas, all these things. We don't know if those were Tiger Swan agents or local law or state law enforcement. We really don't know because they were masked. You know, they had gas masks and they concealed their identities as well. They were certainly, it was being orchestrated in some part by private contractors. But in terms of the infiltration and surveillance that Pam mentioned, I went out to Standing Rock the same, I guess it was weekend, or at the same time that a veterans group had organized to go out, and they were organized by Wes Clark Jr., among others. I think it was 3,000 veterans descended on Standing Rock. The plan was to put their bodies in the way, in between protesters, peaceful protesters, and private security forces. Their philosophy was that we took an oath to defend this country from all enemies, foreign and domestic, and this is our duty. It ended up, actually, they did march to the front line. There was a huge blizzard that weekend, and pretty much everyone was evacuated. So it didn't exactly go according to plan. But also, I think they knew that they were not going to do themselves any favors if they were firing on veterans. So the state and local and federal forces that were there and private forces that were there didn't really do anything. But later, Wes Clark Jr. said that he found out that their entire group was infiltrated by private security contractors, very easily infiltrated. And he said all of our names and addresses and everyone, everything, all of our information is with now either Tiger. I don't know if he called out Tiger Swan exactly, but he said we were very easily infiltrated. And so that was another part of, a big part of what they do is they infiltrate and disrupt. And I think the model for that is COINTELPRO. I think they learned a lot from that. I think they market themselves also as, you know, the tactics and strategy that have been developed over the last 13 years in the war on terror. They can implement that domestically. And I was going to, if I can, I wanted to read the quote. It's a short quote. It's a one-line quote from that leaked document that Pam mentioned, talking about the how they characterize the insurgency, the pipeline insurgency.
It's a juicy quote. Please read it.
Okay, so this is from Tiger Swan, leaked document, leaked to The Intercept, dated February 27th, 2017. What the anti-DAPL protesters have called a, quote, indigenous decolonization movement, end quote, was essentially an externally supported, ideologically driven insurgency with a strong religious component. And, as a generally follow the jihadist insurgency model while active, we can expect the individuals who fought for and supported it to follow a post-insurgency model after its collapse.
Yeah.
Well, so that's how they're thinking about this.
There you have it. Let's talk a bit with the attorney in the room, Pam Spies. These infiltrators, in my experience, have tried to get movement people to do illegal things, and that's the way they set them up. Do you think that that's one of the lessons we learn from the Dakota Access Pipeline protests? You have to be defensive in the way you articulate what you're there, trying to do there.
You know, I think that's something that organizers and leading activists have taken from standing or from that whole process. And I think any time you have a protest that then draws and galvanizes a lot of folks to you, magnetizes a lot of folks to you. I've seen this in other international contexts. I've seen it here, that there's a real need to be able to handle that influx, you know, direct how you need people's solidarity and support to be directed. And yes, be aware that there will be attempts to infiltrate and undermine and sabotage and that sort of thing. And just be very clear, right, about what it is you're there to do and how you intend to do that. But I think infiltration has been, you know, with us as long as forever, right? And the thing is, we now know, you know, Standing Rock gave us such a lesson in how that's happening now, right, as opposed to 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And we're all more connected now, right, where there's so many ways that works against us and it works for us in different ways. So,
one of the other tactics they've used against us is what we call a slap suit. Mm-hmm. The ETP sued everybody they could think of. And I wanted to ask you about, what is a slap suit, who did they sue, and what was the outcome?
So a slap suit it stands for a strategic lawsuit against public participation or political participation. And it's called that because these suits were begun by big companies that were trying to, you know, basically squash opposition. And usually they were, you know, there was a huge disparity in financial resources. And you can imagine a huge company suing a small organization or a group of community leaders can put them out of commission for a long time. And whether or not the suit is has any merit is beside the point, because the whole point of it is to draw people out, sidetrack things, and often they didn't have merit, right? Often they would end up being dismissed, but that could take years. So in a number of states, you have laws called anti-slap laws, which are intended to avoid these types of cases. And so it gives people who are being sued a mechanism to try to get the case dismissed earlier on if it's clearly frivolous and it's intended to harass or chill, you know, their speech and rights. ETP, the company behind DAPL, did bring one of these cases, and it was a sprawling complaint alleging this very bizarre conspiracy between Greenpeace US, Greenpeace International, Banktrack, Earth First, but those are the named defendants. But then within the complaint, it named just about every environmental group you can imagine as part of the conspiracy. And it's a very bizarre case. We think it's a classic slap suit, and Greenpeace and Banktrack and have moved to dismiss it on those grounds. And so we'll see what happens. But it is the second, and the case was brought by the Kasowitz firm, which are Trump's lawyers, right? And it's the second time
I didn't know that. Yeah. Trump's lawyers brought it?
Yeah.
What's the name of the firm again?
Kasowitz. And it's the second case of its kind that this firm has brought. And I don't know whether it's a trend or, you know, but what's very clear is that this company is pursuing this type of strategy, right? And it's alarming for folks, you know, who've never seen this before or had to deal with this before.
I didn't know that about the slap suit, but I think it's always interesting that even in that quote that we read, it said an externally supported movement. And this lawsuit naming all these external organizations, we hear this language all the time. People are saying, oh, well, these are not, you know, these kids are being paid to speak this way about Parkland, or these, you know, there's all these people, these are paid protesters. They're externally supported.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's all this talk about manipulation. And I think getting back to your question of what, you know, how to combat infiltration, I think that's one of the things that people can do is, this isn't about someone paying me. Yeah, we have supporters all over the world because we're morally right. But this is us. Right. And we're not being manipulated. We're not. That, to me, is an act of transparency. This is us. Whatever the movement is, this is about us. We're saying you're crossing our land. You're infringing on our sovereignty. So we're not being manipulated, and that argument is specious. So, therefore, you can feel free to infiltrate us because this is just our message. This is our land. This is our movement. It's not an external actor manipulating us. So we really can't be manipulated, in a sense. It's open. And I think that's one of the elements that I never understand this language of, you know, well, they're being externally manipulated. I, you know, sometimes it's just it's just us. And that's, I think, that's good enough.
Well,
and I will say that that's a tactic that they've also tried to use in Louisiana through these very strange Facebook pages. They did the same thing in Louisiana and in Pennsylvania, where it was learned that this clickbait person who's famous for sort of developing clickbait went on to develop these Facebook pages and then post these videos, hired an actor claiming to be sort of a libertarian in both in Louisiana and in Pennsylvania, using different names in each video, and then targeting local activists there and painting them as, yes, paid protesters, people who are just conning the local folks in Louisiana and in Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, alleged some connection to the Russians. And that's one of the tactics we're seeing being deployed here. And yet, you couldn't have people standing on firmer ground, where they belong, and, showing up as themselves in these fights, and yet they're being targeted as the imposters.
And I think that's one of the lessons from Standing Rock is it was an indigenous-led movement in every way. There was no actor, Greenpeace Grand Wizard, holding all the strings, 1,000 miles away. It was indigenous-led, and it was led by the indigenous people whose land it was just north of the Standing Rock reservations.
Pam Spees, you're an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I know that you're involved in litigation down in Louisiana, the southern terminus of this pipeline. Can you tell us very briefly what the litigation is all about?
Well, there's different aspects to it. With respect to Tiger Swan, I mentioned that they were trying to get into Louisiana to support ETP's pipeline project there. But what happened was that because of what happened at Standing Rock, because of the intercept reporting and the leaked documents, the folks there in Louisiana knew about them already. And so they were advocating at the State Board of Private Security Examiners to keep them out. And fortunately, that board denied their license application, which was a huge, huge victory for Louisiana, right? I mean, you had a board that did the right thing, and it was regulating, right? Tiger Swan announced that it was going to appeal that. Right after that ruling, it hired five lobbyists in the state of Louisiana to do executive branch lobbying. And so what we have done on behalf of some of the groups who are active down there, we filed a petition to intervene into that process so that if the appeal goes forward and it looks like they will be pursuing the appeal, we've asked for these groups to be allowed to intervene as formal parties in that process to make sure that all the concerns about this company are made part of the record. The other things that we're doing down there with them is, a number of public records requests to different state agencies, which Louisiana has a really interesting public records law that allows you to get into court really fast. And we've litigated several of these requests already against the governor's office, local sheriff's office, where the sheriff had been the head of the National Sheriff's Association and in that capacity had traveled to Standing Rock and then came back and wrote some really aggressive posts about that. So a lot's come to light through those public records requests and through that litigation. And most recently, we got records from the Department of Environmental Quality, which really showed both the close working relationship, which is a mild way of putting it, between company representatives and the staff at the Department of Environmental Quality. But it also confirmed for us that the Governor's Office of Homeland Security had been surveilling some of the groups opposing the pipeline, and that those intelligence assessments were being sent to the National Guard, to the FBI, to the state police, and then the heads of these environmental agencies. And so that confirmed something our folks already suspected. But what was so striking about it to everyone was that here you have these folks, all of these high-level folks getting briefed on this tiny opposition, right? They're tiny but very, effective and determined, right? And yet we didn't see anything in the Department of Environmental Quality's records that indicated any kind of concern about the company's track record of accidents, spills, and leaks, right? And ETP, we know, is one, because it is also now incorporated Sunoco, which has one of the worst accident records in the country, these are dangerous companies to be running pipelines through, and they already have an established track record of leaks in these pipelines and accidents, construction accidents and everything. Nothing about that in the DEQ's records that we received.
I wanted to ask you first, Eli Kane. You're a movie producer. What was it personally in your background that got you involved in making your latest movie, On a Knife Edge, about Native Americans?
I don't think I set out specifically to work with Native Americans or to tell a Native American story. I think one of the things that really attracted me to this story was understanding the sacrifice that is so often necessary when one dedicates one's life to social justice or to struggle. I think that's one aspect of the film that we really explore, because George, the son, does get exhausted. He does get disillusioned, and his father has to say, you really don't have a choice. You have to dedicate yourself to this cause. This is who we are. This is what we've always done. This is being done to us. And it doesn't really matter. You know, you just have to decide what kind of player you want to be, but you can't decide to sit out. And that is a lesson that I think is hard learned. I think he does learn it. I think Standing Rock was a galvanizing moment for him in the film. But that side of the story, I think, is often overlooked. It's the side of the story which is personally of interest to me. My grandparents were both radicals. They were communists. My grandfather fought in Spain. The FBI harassed them his whole life almost. And, you know, I think that that kind of dedication, I think it did take a toll on them and on their lives. And I think that it's the cost that is often overlooked when we tell stories about revolutionaries or radicals. We often overlook the exhaustion. You know, that side of things, I think, is very important to explore, and it's important to acknowledge. You know, I think radicals can be killed, they can be jailed, but often they just become exhausted. And I think that's a very, very important point, and it's an interesting point to me to explore. And so it's one of the things about this film that I'm most proud.
Thank you, Eli.
Thank you.
Pam, how did you get involved with the center and the kind of litigation that you're doing now?
Well, I've been with the center for 8 years now. I'm from Louisiana originally, so I had worked years ago with Rhonda Copeland through in some of who had been an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we worked in the international women's human rights movement and some of the developments that were happening there in the late 90s and early 2000s. I then went back to Louisiana and was practicing there for a number of years, and then cycled back to New York to come back to and work at the Center for Constitutional Rights. So doing mostly international human rights work, right, in that docket. And so what's been so gratifying to be involved in this work with the folks in Louisiana is to be bringing that experience and that perspective into the work and in support of the movement there.
Well, Attorney Pam Spies, documentary film producer Eli Kane, you haven't run out of energy. It's been wonderful having you on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The United States of America has been in a perpetual state of war since 9/11/2001, and before that almost continuously since 1918, 100 years ago. The USA has overthrown democratically elected governments it could not control since its invasion of Mexico in 1848. It has overturned elected governments and assassinated or attempted to assassinate many heads of foreign countries. World War I, which started in 1914 and ended in 1918, was a massive slaughter between imperial powers, with the United States, France, Britain, and Russia on one side against Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire on the other. It lasted over 3 years. In 1 week alone, Great Britain lost 250,000 young men. That war wiped out almost an entire generation. It had been billed as the war to end all wars. November 11th was the day the armistice was signed, ending World War I. It was made into an American national holiday to venerate peace. It was called Armistice Day. But by 1953, Armistice Day had turned into Veterans Day, and fighting, violence, and militarism was glorified. Donald Trump plans to spend $30 million on a massive military parade on the streets of Washington, D.C. this coming November 11th, Veterans Day. Tanks and missiles and troops will be paraded through the streets of our nation's capital in a show of military force and adulation of Trump. A coalition of anti-war organizations are planning mass actions against this military parade and the normalization of war, violence, and authoritarianism. Here to speak with us today is Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu Baraka is an initiator and leader of the Black Alliance for Peace, an organization which is part of the coalition. He has also just returned from a meeting of international leaders because the USA's involvement in a possible overthrow of the government of Venezuela. Ajamu Baraka helped organize a conference in Baltimore last month concerning America's 800 bases abroad, particularly the new ones in Africa. Ajamu Baraka, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to Law and Disorder.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
Ajamu, talk about the organizing going on now to rain on Trump's parade, which is scheduled for Veterans Day, November 11th. The coalition is called No Trump Military Parade. Who's involved, and what are the plans and the demands?
Well, thank you for that question. I think this is a very important issue that people need to be aware of. This is an effort that's being pulled together by various elements of the anti-war community here in the U.S. And the objective is to try to put a brake on this process of normalizing militarism here in this culture. So as your listeners know, the Trump administration wants to have a parade on November the 11th. And we are saying that we want to resist that, that we want to demonstrate that there is a significant number of people in the U.S. That are opposed to the glorification of war. So we are asking people to join this emerging coalition and to come to D.C. on November the 8th to be a part of alternative events to the Trump war parade. Now, you know, what's interesting about this, Michael, is that here we have this announcement for this parade right in the midst of a national discussion around the issue of gun control and gun violence here in the U.S. And for me, it demonstrates this sort of psychological disconnect that people tend to have between militarism as it is expressed and implemented abroad and the militarization of the culture domestically. When people are not seeing the connection and not being profoundly insulted and outraged by this proposal.
Yeah, the connection is very, very real. In countries that have video games that are violent, like, say, Japan, but where citizens don't have access or own guns like they do here, you don't have this kind of thing. You don't have it, say, in Australia. But here, we have almost as many guns as people. You have, I think the statistic is since 1968, 1.5 million people have died by gunfire. 1.5 million, that's 30,000 a year in the United States.
Yes.
And there's no connection. There's in the popular media, there's no connection between 1.5 million. That's more people that died in all the wars that America's ever fought. 1.5 million. There's no connection between that militarized culture and guns and what's going on. So I think that the demonstration that you're helping to organize is extraordinarily important. And there's another aspect, too, I wanted to ask you, Ajamu. The budget to accommodate U.S. militarism is growing and now constitute 57% of our federal disposable spending. How has this affected programs for, say, food or education or housing or health?
Yeah, no, that's a very important question. And before I address that directly, let me just go back and finish answering your first question, just so people are clear about what we're trying to do with the counter demonstration or the counter march, if you will, you know, it's very important for people to understand that our objectives are that we want to stop the glorification of war. And that's why it's important to have a real physical presence in D.C. We want to return this Veterans Day back to its in original idea, which was a day to celebrate the end of war as opposed to the glorification of war. We want to raise the issue on that day also of the absolute necessity to divest from the war machine and to use the public funds that are being used for death and destruction to redivert those funds to addressing the real human and material needs of the people. And we want to call attention to the fact that not only do we have the wars abroad, but we have the wars that are taking place here in the U.S. domestically, the systematic assault on the dignity and human rights of people in this country by police forces and ICE agencies and all of these institutions that are assaulting the dignity of people. So we want to stop all of this kind of institutionalized violence we see here in this country. And it's connected to your question around the issue of the budget, the military budget. And as you said, here we have a budget that's now taking between 54% and 57% of all discretionary spending here in this country. And that is really obscene. This was a bipartisan agreement in February that has now the government committed to spending several hundred billion dollars for the military. It means that non-military discretionary spending is holding now at about 46% of the budget, and military spending, as I said, is now between 54% and 57% of the budget. It reflects a obscene increase of almost $80 billion for the military, which represents a military budget that completely dwarfs everything else and all of the other spending by most of the nations on the planet. And in fact, it represents a military budget that is bigger than the next nine nations combined. This is really a grotesque misuse of public resources. And the consequence of this is that it means that we are not going to be able to address the real needs of the people here in this country. Because what it reflects is that there has to be now cuts in spending for vital programs. The Trump budget for 2019, they're calling for spending cuts of something like 26% on health. They want to cut back on food stamps, the whole agricultural department, to the tune of something like 19%. They want to reduce spending for education. They're reducing protections for labor, something like 35%. Housing's being cut by something like 14%. So to pay for the military spending, they have to, and they are, in fact, proposing and are attempting to implement vital cuts in the programs really important to working class or poor people here in this country. So this austerity, if you will, is part of the systematic class assault that we're seeing coming from both the Trump administration and the previous Democratic administrations over the last 30 to 40 years.
Last month, members of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, voted to give the Pentagon $70 billion more than the Pentagon had requested in its current budget. How do you understand this?
As part of the class war being executed against the American people. Basically, the ruling elements have decided that they are going to use military force, both domestically and abroad, to maintain the hegemony of capital and the capitalist system. And to do that, they have to prop up, they argue, the military, and to do that, they also have to get public support for those kinds of obscene expenditures. So this is all part of their agenda, and we have to be very clear about this and make sure that people understand that agenda, this thing that they refer to as national interest, is not the interest of the people, but it reflects really the interest of this 1%, this ruling elite that is squandering our resources in order to advance their particular class interests. So I understand this as part of the intensification of class warfare in the United States of America.
We're speaking with the Jammu Baraka, who is the initiator and one of the leaders of the Black Alliance for Peace, and he's helping to organize the No Trump Military Parade, which Trump has called for Veterans Day on November 11th. It's a call for people to come to Washington, D.C. on November 8th to protest. The United States of America is the largest empire in the world. It has some 800 bases in foreign countries. You recently helped organize a conference in Baltimore on American bases abroad. How many bases do the United States have in foreign countries? Is it 800? Where are they? And what is their purpose?
We have organized a new coalition, the No U.S. Foreign Bases Coalition that we launched in Baltimore in January. Its primary objective is to, one, call attention to the fact that right now there are over 800 of these bases around the world, these U.S. bases, and some people will say even up to 1,000, depending on how one defines the term base. And these bases are in almost 100, really over 170 nations of the 193 nations or so on the planet. The reach of the U.S. military is quite extensive. So the coalition is to help bring attention to the fact that this vast network of U.S. bases exists in order for people to understand that the U.S. is, in fact, an empire and that its ability to maintain its empire status requires this extensive kind of military apparatus in terms of bases and these obscene expenditures of resources. So part of our effort to combat militarism and the war fever is to bring attention to this extensive network of military bases. So the coalition is doing that. We're now developing an international coalition because we know that it's not just enough to look at U.S. foreign bases, which are important. We want to look at also the entire sort of Western basing process that's also connected to NATO. And so we want to bring the attention to the entire, what I call the pan-European colonial capitalist project. So this international coalition is being built. We're going to have a international conference in Ireland in November. So this is, again, part of the educational process because many people don't know that the U.S. has this extensive foreign bases and that we're spending $156 billion a year to maintain these bases and to maintain these connections between the U.S. military and repressive militaries around the world.
That's the No U.S. Foreign Bases Coalition. Jammu, when I recently looked at a map of where these bases are, you can see they're encircling Iran, encircling China, encircling Russia. What's your reaction when you take a look at the map and you see where those bases are located?
Well, my reaction is that basically it just confirms what we already know about the intent, the objective of those bases. And what we have to do is to communicate that information to the general public that these bases are situated in a way in which they become an aggressive and intimidating factor for these nations that are in the crosshairs of U.S. Imperial policies. So it becomes understandable why, for example, the Russians would be feeling very intimidated by the fact that there are bases that surround the Russian territory and that NATO is funneling U.S. and European forces on the Russian western border and that the Chinese would be concerned about the military pivot to Asia and the basing processes that have resulted in the encirclement of China. The same thing with the Iranians, that these military bases are strategically placed to provide the forward operating capacity for aggressive military actions on the part of the U.S. state. So this reality needs to be communicated to the American people, and the American people have to make determinations to what extent they want their resources to be utilized for these kinds of aggressive military operations. We say that they have to be removed. We say that if there's going to be issues that have to be that are seen as threats to international peace, we have international mechanisms in place within the context of the UN to address those kinds of issues, as opposed to the unilateral actions on the part of any state to take in its own hands military actions to advance its interests or to solve or to address political issues.
John Mubaraka, the peace movement faded from view during Obama's terms in office. Despite the U.S. wars in Libya and Syria and escalation of the war in Afghanistan, and U.S. bases have expanded across the African continent. Please talk with us about the significance of AFRICOM. What is it and what does it do?
AFRICOM is the U.S. African Command that was consolidated in the latter part of 2008 as part of the U.S. Global command structure. And the objective of AFRICOM is to engage in what many of us call the recolonization of Africa through military means on the part of the U.S. and in conjunction with its allies. So we've seen that there's been an escalation, an expansion, if you will, of U.S. presence on the African continent in terms of a military presence over the last decade. That process was really accelerated as a result of the attack and destruction of the state of Libya, which was the state that was most responsible for helping to keep African nations resisting the attempt to reinvade the African continent militarily. But once they targeted and destroyed the Libyan state, we've seen a dramatic increase in the U.S. presence on the African continent. Your listeners may recall that just a few weeks ago, the news came out that there were military personnel in Mali and in Niger, where some military personnel were, in fact, lost their lives. And many people didn't know that we had military forces on the ground in those far-off countries, if you will. But that is the reality. There are military forces in various African nations. Right now, we see an uptick in places, even places like Mozambique, where the U.S. is using the threat of so-called terrorism to increase its presence on the African continent. And Michael, there's another very clear political economic objective to the U.S. Concern about Africa. They want to block the entry and the expansion of the Chinese. And since they're not prepared to engage in a kind of investment activity that the Chinese is engaged in terms of how the Chinese work with various African countries, their response to Chinese growing influence in Africa is to increase their influence militarily.
John Mubaraka, I want to shift our attention to Venezuela. You recently attended an international meeting to discuss the defense of Venezuela, considering that the U.S. is intent upon regime change there. Talk about the meeting, please. What's the U.S. doing, and what can people do about it?
Well, as your listeners probably know, the U.S. has been involved in a process of destabilization with the intent of trying to execute so-called regime change in Venezuela the last few years, and quite some time before that. But it's been intensified under the Obama administration, and the intent is basically to remove the present government and to install a dictatorship represented by the Venezuelan oligarchy. That effort has been intensified over the last few months with this draconian sanction regime that's been slapped on the country. The result has been that there's economic instability in the country. They have coupled that with providing political support and other kinds of support to the opposition that's been engaged in violent oppositional activity in the country for quite some time. And the U.S. Moved to undermine the talks that were being held between the government and the opposition to the extent that, and I know we're running out of time, but to the extent that there was an agreement that was the government thought they had with the opposition a few weeks ago, but Rex Tillerson, we believe, basically ordered the opposition not to sign the agreement. Now, part of the agreement was to have a presidential election and to reduce the tensions inside the country and to repair the economy. But the opposition pulled out of that agreement, and many people believe that the reason for that was that the U.S. is now intended on regime change, and that's why they have announced that they're not going to acknowledge the upcoming presidential election in May, and that they are driving very aggressively to change the government in Venezuela.
We've been speaking with Ajamu Baraka, who is the organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace. Ajamu, before we let you go, can you give our listeners information on how they can get out on the Black Alliance for Peace, how they can reach the No Trump Military Parade and the No U.S. Foreign Bases Coalition?
Definitely. Please, for folks who are concerned about this parade, go to the notrumpmilitaryparade.us to get more information. You can sign up to be part of this effort. Please, in fact, consider doing that. You can go to the nousforeignbases.org website to be a part and to join the No U.S. Foreign Bases Coalition. And, of course, you can also go, and we need your support, go to the Black Alliance for Peace .com to support our efforts in trying to revive and rebuild anti-war movement, anti-imperialist movement here in this country. There's some exciting work taking place, and we need all the help that we can get to reverse U.S. militarism and to put a brake on U.S. imperialism.
Ajamu Baraka, thank you so much for the great work that you're doing, and thank you for being a guest on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.